This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. I don't know about you, but when I think back on my teenage years, I'm happy that they're over. I'm grateful for the people who guided me through that tumultuous time. I'm embarrassed about some of the stupid things I did, and I feel lucky that I got through relatively unscathed. Our guest, psychiatrist Daniel Siegel, says that teenagers get a bad rap, and that things would be easier for parents, adults, even teens themselves, if we better understood the teenage brain. Siegel also says parents might have an easier time with their kids if they remembered what they were like when they were adolescents, and they might even enjoy their adulthood more if they thought and acted more like teenagers. Daniel Siegel is the author of Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. He's clinical professor of psychiatry at UCLA School of Medicine, also co-director of the UCLA Mindful Awareness Research Center, and he joins us from the studios in New York City. And Daniel Siegel, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Wonderful to be here, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So what were you like as a teenager?
Oh, my. Well, there were lots of different stages for me, as there are for many people. I think the early time was the most difficult, and then it seemed to get easier and easier as it went on. But, you know, it continued on into my mid-20s, as it does with many of us. And so we need to know that adolescence actually is not the end of the teenage years. It goes on into our 20s.
In fact, I found that interesting, is that you sort of mark the end of adolescence and maybe even this teenage brain, the development or evolution of this teenage brain, into really the mid-20s.
That's right. You know, we start the changes of the adolescent brain, which we didn't know about in even before the teenage years begin. For some of us, it's around 11 or 12. Females a little earlier than males. And the changes that we didn't know about were that the brain begins to remodel itself. So many of the things that get set up in the teenage years that continue throughout adolescence into the mid-20s are actually based on changes in the brain, not some of the myths we hear about, like raging hormones or just some period of immaturity. It's a necessary period of what's called remodeling of the brain.
Take us through that remodeling project. I mean, what for instance, an 11-year-old's brain looks like and how it ends up a 24-year-old's brain.
Absolutely. Well, when you think about brain development in general, the brain is the organ in the head that allows us to feel and think and make decisions. It's actually the organ that allows us to have social relationships and even what determines how we behave, what we do with our bodies. The brain from, let's say, birth to 12 is kind of like a sponge. It soaks in the knowledge of the world around it. It takes in what adults are telling him or her, and it builds a whole scaffold of information that is basically how the brain is making new connections. These connections, called synapses, form the actual structure of the brain. Then what happens in adolescence, around puberty with sexual maturation, is something that surprised everyone. Instead of the brain continuing to act like a sponge where you're just soaking in knowledge, making new connections, building structure, the brain starts to do two really big things. The first is it starts to prune itself down. So instead of just continuing to accumulate new connections, it actually is going to start carving away existing connections and even the basic cells, the neurons themselves, so the brain is going to become less populated, if you will, but more specialized as it gets rid of what it doesn't need. Then the remaining neurons and their connections will become even more strongly connected to each other with something called myelin. And myelin is a substance that allows the communication between neurons to be basically 3,000 times both faster and more coordinated. So the brain, in essence, is pruning, carving down what you don't need, and then taking what remains and making it more connected. And this is the way you specialize and differentiate circuits and then link them with more strength so the brain becomes what we say more integrated into the 20s. And this is a good thing, a really good thing.
And is that then the goal of the teenage brain, to be more integrated as it goes into adulthood?
You know, it is one of the important goals to become more integrated, because integration basically is where you're more coordinated and balanced. So if you look at how a brain works, let's say in a 7-year-old compared to a 17-year-old, the brain actually is more efficient in how it processes information and makes decisions into late adolescence compared to a child. They're both important periods of life, but they just have different purposes.
Mm. We do associate, and I think largely correctly, with more sort of risk-taking or even, as you write in the book, more novelty-seeking with teenagers. Does our understanding of the brain help us understand this feature that we associate with adolescence?
Absolutely. Well, what the science says is that we are three times more likely to have a permanent injury or even death from a preventable cause during this second dozen years of life, even though during this same period, our bodies are stronger and healthier than at any other time. So you say, well, why? And it's exactly what you're saying, Marty. One of the reasons is risk-taking behavior. Now you can say, well, why would nature design a brain to actually take more risks? And the way to think about it is this. The child is living in a familiar home that's comfortable and there's certainty, and usually, not for everybody, but for most kids, it's safe. For nature to get this individual, the child, to go through a period of development where they're going to leave that familiar home and set out in the world as an adult to take on responsibilities, to set up a family, you got to do something to the brain so that the comfort and familiarity and certainty and safety of the home is something that you feel a little restless with. So if you were nature, what would you do?
Hmm.
Well, you know, it's not so easy to think about it, but when you understand the circuits of the brain, there are two big things that happen that get a child out of the house, basically. You make the brain more emotional. So literally the adolescent brain after puberty becomes filled with emotions much more than a child. And the second thing is you have this brain have a push towards doing new things. And you do that by two mechanisms. One is you change what's called the reward circuit of the brain. The reward circuit basically is driven by a chemical called dopamine. And by dropping essentially the baseline levels of dopamine and raising the release levels, you make the child, who's now an adolescent with this changed reward system, want to do something to secrete more dopamine to get out of the doldrums of low dopamine. Because when you release dopamine, it feels good. It's rewarding. The top thing in nature that secretes dopamine is novelty, doing something new. So you push the adolescent away from the familiar, comfortable certainty of home, and you got to take risks when you leave home. So part of going to what's not safe is a drive to novelty. And this is the change in the reward circuit. But nature does one more thing, which no one really knew about until recently. It changes the balance of how an adolescent weighs the exciting parts of a choice, like if I'm going to drive 100 miles an hour with a brand new car, versus the downsides of a choice, like, oh my gosh, I could get killed, I could hurt the car, I could kill someone else. Now, in that balancing act, what we know now from research is the adolescent is fully aware of the dangers, but evaluates them so he or she pays much more attention and values the positive, exciting aspects of a choice and just devalues. It's just not that interested, not concerned about what they actually know about and even know is not only could happen, but they sometimes overestimate the chance of it happening. This is called hyper-rational thinking. They basically rationalize why driving 100 miles an hour is okay. So it's not impulsive. It's actually hyper-rational thinking combined with this dopamine drive to try an exciting thing that's new.
In fact, you include a story in your book about a professor, sounds like he was even a mentor to you, who was killed by a 19-year-old who was going 90 miles an hour on the highway, and he happened to be, obviously, wrong place, wrong time.
Exactly right, Marty. You know, for me, when my son was one, this terrible accident happened with my professor, and he was my mentor, where an adolescent was driving that fast, and sadly, his hyper-rational, dopamine-driven behavior led him to do this. It's also made worse when you're around peers or think that your peers will know what you're doing. So whether they're watching you in the car with you or you think they're going to observe you from afar or even hear the story later on, you trying to impress them with your dopamine-driven, hyper-rational risk-taking behavior makes those risks even worse. And sadly, my professor was killed. Now, with my one-year-old in my arms, I thought, gosh, if there's something I can do as his dad, that when he goes through adolescence, he has some kind of what now I would call an internal compass, so that when he was aware of an impulse, like to drive that fast, he actually would resist it. So part of why I wrote the Brainstorm book was to, if there's any way to have an adolescent, because it's written for adolescents and adults to read, have an adolescent develop that internal compass, so even though they may feel the impulse to drive that fast, they would actually use another way of making decisions besides the hyper-rational, dopamine-driven ones that would give them a feeling like, God, in my gut, in my heart, this just doesn't feel right, so I'm not going to do it because I'm telling myself to not to do it. I'm not listening to my mom. I'm not listening to the police. I'm not even paying attention to the adult-created sign that says 35 miles per hour is the speed limit. But I'm deciding for myself it's not the right thing to do.
In fact, I can imagine someone listening to your description of the human of the teenage brain and the kind of behaviors that are associated with that, and say it's a form of the Twinkie defense, which is, you know, I'm not responsible. I have this crazy brain that's going through all these changes, and that's why I am doing the things that I am doing.
Well, this is the balancing act. You know, the great thing about realizing it's the brain and the brain's changes is that rather than the myth that it's raging hormones, and hormones certainly are rising, but they're not raging, it's really the changes in the brain. And here's the great thing, Marty. When you know what's going on in your brain, you can use your mind to change the function and the structure of the brain. So what I offer is the exercises in the book, these MindSight exercises, that actually can increase the integration of the brain that creates that internal compass that can guide your behavior in a healthy and safe way.
We're about a minute before our first break here, but it also, it seems, goes back to the relationship then between a parent and a child as they're going through this period. And it's a relationship that is often tested in this time period.
It's totally tested. And, you know, the third section of the book, I put it in, and it's really a big moment where we talk about relationships and how important they are between adolescents and adults, both the parents and other adult figures, and how we can keep those lines of communication open and keep the relationship strong through the changes and challenges of adolescence.
Well, I want to pick up on that after this very short break. And again, Daniel Siegel is our guest. We're talking about his new book, and it's called Brainstorm, and it's subtitled The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. He is co-director of the UCLA Mindful Awareness Research Center, also a psychiatrist at UCLA. Taking a short break, as I said, we'll get back to our conversation. Lines open. We'd love to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
AT&T Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. Now on stage, AT&T's annual political comedy, This is the Week That Is. Written and performed by Philadelphia's own Jennifer Childs and This is the Week That Is ensemble, this annual political satire features a script that changes with the headlines and up-to-the-minute reporting on the day's most important news, from Russian invasions to dog curbing in South Philadelphia. Tickets at 1812productions.org.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. What makes economic sanctions work? We'll look at the effect they've had in North Korea and Iran and ask, are there lessons to be learned as the U.S. tries to use sanctions to get Russia to back off in Ukraine? That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Fox Chase was recognized and highlighted among Philadelphia hospitals for safety and surgical outcomes based on a nationwide study. Surgeons at Fox Chase are fellowship trained with up to 4 years of additional training on the complex techniques of cancer surgery. part of Temple Health, Fox Chase is committed to patient safety, world-class care, and the best outcomes. Fox Chase Cancer Center, your first choice in cancer care.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain. If you're just joining us, Daniel Siegel is our guest, and he's taking us inside a teenager's head, inside their brain, to help us understand some of what we're learning about the teenage brain and how it helps to explain teenage behavior. His book is titled Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. And again, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Going back to your description about this novelty seeking and how the brain is seeking out these experiences, and part of that is to I guess encourage the teenager to leave home and go out into the world and become an adult. Does it also explain why they think their parents are total jerks?
Yes, yeah, so Marty, you're really talking about the eye rolling that
yeah,
you
I was
know
just
you're
thinking of the eye rolling. Yes, indeed.
Oh my gosh,
did it myself.
Totally, me too. And, you know, as a parent, of course, it's really painful to have your adolescent roll his or her eyes at you and realize that you are actually a person, not a god or a hero or heroine. And, you know, part of the challenge in writing the adolescent part of this story, as well as the adult part in one book, the Brainstorm book, was how do you actually support both adults and adolescents to understand the eye rolling, for example? So, if you think about it this way, nature needs the adolescent to embrace this experience of basically trying new things. That's the dopamine change so that you're pushed for novelty. But also to have a way in which the higher part of the brain, this cortex, is ready to push against the status quo. And in many ways, for our human family, it's the adolescent's willingness to take on the adult world and think about a different way of doing things that allows our human species to be so profoundly adaptive. Mm. This push against the status quo, basically, if you think about our life as adults, you know, we find our niche in life, we work really hard, if we're fortunate, we have relationships and set up a family, and in those responsibilities, it's tiring, we come home, we want to just put our feet up and relax, listen to some NPR, you know, just hang loose. And an adolescent is restless to just accept the status quo like that. And the world is forever changing. We live on a planet that is always changing. And I believe the reason the human species, for good or for bad, has been so adaptive to live in every aspect of this planet is because the adolescent is able to take on the world and say, you know something? I know my adults who've raised me and taught me have done it this way, but I'm going to try it a different way. I'm going to roll my eyes at what they've set up and say, I don't accept it as the end be all and end all, and I'll try it a new way. And therefore, you look at, let's say, art and music and even science and technology, and most of the innovations that come in those fields are from adolescent minds, ready to try on new things. There's a courage and creativity this period. And I think that's what the eye rolling is. So for an adult reading Brainstorm, what I've heard from people who've read it is it's given them a sense of peace that the eye rolling they don't have to take personally, that you can understand this is literally millions of years of evolution in mammals in general for adolescents, and more recently for us as human beings, to really have a necessary period of pushback. And pushback doesn't have to mean disrespecting or getting rid of adults in your life. It means setting up your own internal sense of how to see the world. And sometimes that involves pushing back. And if adults get upset about it and reactive, of course, it starts a fight. But instead, when you take a deep breath as the parent and say, okay, this isn't part of what evolution has built, I can work by holding the lines of communication open and say, well, how do you say things? And actually, what you learn is that there's some pretty innovative ways adolescents think when you really give them a chance to communicate with respect.
In fact, there are many things I got from your book, but one of them is that adults could learn a lot from teenagers about novelty, about seeking out new experiences, about some of the, you know, scary excitement of the world that we live in.
You know, Marty, this was one of the most surprising things about writing this book. I mean, it was the hardest book I've ever written, and part of it was because to get the right approach to reach both adolescents and adults, you know, which hasn't been done before, was really hard. And now I know why it doesn't exist, because it's to find that one way of communicating with both populations is challenging. But the surprising thing that came up was that when you look at the essence of adolescent brain changes, I'm kind of an acronym nut, it actually spells out the word essence. There is an emotional spark, ES. There's a social engagement, a connection with your peers, SE. There's the novelty we've been speaking about, N. And we have just been talking about the creative explorations, the pushing against the status quo, CE. That spells essence. So the thing that amazed me was, if you look at the studies of the adult brain and what we as adults need to have in our life to keep our brain growing well and strong throughout the lifespan, because the brain doesn't stop growing after adolescence. It keeps on growing. And we can do things to keep it stronger. If you had to pick the top four things that empirical scientific research says are the top four things we should be doing, it's keep passion in your life with an emotional spark, keep friends in your life with social engagement, try new things, novelty, and actually challenge your mind with creative exploration. So the essence of adolescence turns out to be the essence of how we as adults can live a vital life. And so if we've lost it, like many adults have, adolescence can be an inspiration to us, because they can remind us not just of what we used to have and, oh my God, poor us, but actually we can get it back and keep our brains growing well throughout the lifespan.
This may be a bit of a tangent, but as I was reading about and actually hearing you describe this sort of the novelty seeking, the seeking of stimulation, I was wondering about things like ADHD, which, you know, my very basic understanding of that is that there's some of that as well, the kind of novelty seeking, the stimulation seeking. Is there some parallel here without getting too deep into the teenage brain?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the important parallel is that when you look at the brain in some studies, not all studies, of individuals with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, which has various names and there's various forms of it. But in general, what you find is that it is the dopamine system that has a lower dopamine level. And that makes people feel really restless. And dopamine is used to pay attention. And that's why the major medications, the stimulants that are used in appropriate dosages, actually raise dopamine levels. Mm-hmm. And when this condition, which has lower dopamine, is responding to a medication that raises dopamine, you can now focus attention. And the risk-taking behavior is reduced. So it's exactly like you're saying. Since novelty and risk secrete dopamine, if you have something like ADHD, of course, you're going to be more likely to do something to get it squirted. You're going to shift attention. You're going to try something exciting. You're going to do things to get that dopamine elevated. Sadly, one of the things we should just mention, both for people who have untreated ADHD as well as for adolescents, there's a risk of taking chemicals like alcohol or other drugs of addiction that can get you to increase dopamine secretion temporarily. So that any activity or drug, or even now we know high glycemic, that is high sugar-releasing foods, are addictive because they entrain the dopamine system. So there are some overlaps that are very important to point out. Thank you, Marty. Yes, absolutely.
And that's Daniel Siegel, our guest today on Radio Times. He's a psychiatrist, a clinical professor of psychiatry at UCLA Medical School, and also author of this new book we're talking about called Brainstorm, and it's subtitled The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cowain. Let me ask you another question, then I do want to get to our callers, because I think some teenagers are just overtly rebellious. And you know, we know who they are. We know what those behaviors are about. And some teenagers are, frankly, just, you know, more conformist, or they're just sort of more rule followers, if I can put it that way. Does that mean that their brains are developing differently?
Well, you know, there is a very important part of our lives called temperament. And there's a wide range of temperamental features we have, and there's different ways of measuring it and naming it. But absolutely, you can have different temperament before adolescence happens. And what's interesting is that that temperament before adolescence doesn't necessarily predict how your adolescence will go, but it does help understand why you see one adolescent, you see another adolescent, they're not all the same by any means. We're all unique individuals. Partly, our attachment history can determine that. If we've been traumatized in the past, we may feel frightened of doing things that are scary. And so in adolescence, you may be even more frightened. And so you really remove yourself from things that are risk-taking. So there's going to be lots of things. Attachment experiences, which I talk a lot in the book. Temperament, which we talk about, that help us understand why there's mm-hmm. such variation. However, when you look across cultures and even across species, you find that there is a propensity, for example, in adolescence to be more at risk of becoming addicted to drugs that secrete dopamine. That's not just true in human beings. That's found to be true in mice, for example. You see risk-taking behavior, for example, in adolescent antelope, where they will actually, the adolescents will, not the really young children, if you will, antelope or the adults, but the adolescents will go up to a lion pride, take a close look at them, take a deep whiff, and then run away. You know, and you say, well, wow, why would an adolescent do that? Well, in part, it's getting ready to be responsible as an adult. You've got to see what the dangers are out there, because those adolescents, this is going to sound odd, I know, for the parents listening to this, but those adolescents who are willing to take risks to a certain degree, clearly where they're not going to be killed and they won't be injured permanently, but who can take risks, are actually going to be more prepared for adulthood because they've been practicing under the safety of still being at home. And this is where, you know, I quote one of my colleagues in the Brainstorm book and in a book she wrote, which says, it's actually safer to be a risk taker as an adolescent than to actually never take risks and not be prepared when you're launching out into the world without ever having the safety of home to actually try out things. So for parents, we need to take a deep breath because it is a dangerous time. It is a scary time. There's no question about that. But keeping the lines of communication open to support your adolescent trying new things in the world is something very important to do.
Let me get, looks like Lou from Westchester to join our conversation. Hi, Lou. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. How are you?
Good.
Dr. Siegel, my question, I read a book several years ago, and it talked about the development of the adolescent brain in regards to how the instinctive area of the brain communicates with the logistic area of the brain. So that connection, which we say, why did you do something? And you say, well, I was angry, so I threw the plate or whatever. Sometimes you ask a teenage boy why he did something, and the emotion is there and his reaction is there, but the logic and the analysis of it isn't quite connected yet. Can you address that at all?
Thanks for the call, Lou. Yeah, go ahead, Daniel Siegel.
Yeah, thanks, Lou. I appreciate it. You know, I'm so glad you weren't quoting the way the popular media, including books, call teens crazy, which is so insulting and so wrong. So let's talk about exactly what you're talking about. And it's a really nice way that you're presenting it, that there are different areas of the brain that perhaps are not as integrated as they will be later on. Integration is where you have different parts that become linked together. So the way you're describing it is the lower parts of the brain, some people might call them instinctual, some people might call them emotional. These are areas that are below the higher, what you're calling logical or logistical, or we'll call it, you know, the reasoning part of the brain, which is the cortex, the top of the brain. So there's no question that the way these two areas communicate with each other shifts even from childhood to adolescence. So the way we capture that in the essence word is emotional spark. It's really clear from research, the body itself, the lower areas, the brainstem, the limbic area, these lower areas of the brain have the origins of emotion arising in them, and they push up into the reasoning cortex to take over the part of the cortex that actually determines what you do with your body. Now, the feeling of that when you're a young adolescent can be impulsivity, which can be prevalent in this early time. Later on, it can be more interpreted as an emotion just took me over, because it did. And what we want to do, and what I do in the Brainstorm book, is teach reflective practices. So rather than just being confused by your emotional waves, if you will, we need to teach adolescents to surf those waves and to understand what the emotions are. And this is actually what I call a mindsight skill that's teachable. So I believe in middle schools and high schools, everyone should be learning reflective skills so that, yes, the brain is more emotional, and yes, it's going through a period of integration, but we actually know ways you can train your mind to become more fluid at understanding the impact of emotion on your reasoning and then alter the way you make decisions. So this is not something that just it is and so, oh my God, it is that way. You can actually teach skills to strengthen the ability to surf those emotional waves. Absolutely.
Lou, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Daniel Siegel, you mentioned the name of a book with a really insulting title about teenagers. But as you say, and it's pretty clear, there are a lot of negative messages and stereotypes about teenagers being, you know, rude and lazy and self-centered and out of control.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
I mean, it's a pretty long list, but I wonder, since we're talking about teenagers, you know, how they interpret how the world, misinterprets, according to you, misinterprets their behavior.
Absolutely. Well, Marty, listen, if someone said to you, hey, you're going to act in these really crazy ways that are really basically just immature, and you should just get over it. And by the way, there are raging hormones streaming around your blood flow that are going to make you mad and crazy and lazy and insulting, and there's nothing you can do about it, so just hurry up and get over it.
Right.
Like, what is there in any of that that's respectful? What is there in any of that that is actually empowering? And I got to say, what is there in any of that that's actually true? Because here's the problem. When adults take this attitude toward adolescence and shape, for example, curricula in middle school and high school that just gets rid of anything that supports the emotional spark of adolescence, it gets rid of the collaborative nature of adolescence to support each other, gets them to compete with each other. It doesn't let them try new things. It just crams them the same old kind of approach to school. And then it doesn't give them any opportunity, usually, to have creative exploration. It's just memorize stuff and take an exam. And everyone feels so pressured and to hurry up and get the best GPA and the best SAT score and all this stuff. You know, so the sad thing is there's nothing supporting the essence of adolescence. So naturally, yes, they become discouraged. Mm. And yes, they aren't paying attention because we're not understanding what's going on in their brains to help reach them effectively. So I understand why adults say these things, but instead of blaming the adolescent, let's reorganize how we approach school so that we can change the message in school, change the message at home, change the message through the media like we're doing right now, where we can change the cultural conversation around adolescence and empower them and support their essence. Because every one of these pieces of essence has a downside and it has an upside. And when we're blind to the essence, the downside is what arises, for sure. Why not actually pay attention to this and support the upside to each of these aspects of the essence of adolescence?
And let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation and our callers. And again, Daniel Siegel is our guest. He's a clinical professor of psychiatry at UCLA School of Medicine, co-director of the UCLA Mindful Awareness Research Center, author of a new book called Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. I do want to get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And why not tweet us at Marty Moss Cohen? Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the 2014 Lincoln MKZ with standard Lincoln drive control, offering normal comfort and sport driving modes. Details about the MKZ and its features are available at Lincoln.com.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Music, epic in its scope, in its spirit. Yannick Nezet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra perform Bruckner's final unfinished Ninth Symphony. And Lisa Batyashvili plays the first violin concerto of the young, heartbroken Béla Bartók. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or at philorg.org. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, Lisa Batyashvili, Yannick Nezet-Séguin, and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Next time on The Takeaway, we're talking about the Fourth Amendment. It's all about search and seizure and smartphones.
Checking my sources. I'm always learning new things.
The Supreme Court hears arguments on whether law enforcement officers can search the phones of a person arrested. We look at how the law changes with the technology of the times. Plus all the day's news and your comments. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
The Wan Institute supports WHYY. They're a graduate school offering acupuncture and herbal medicine in Glenside and in Hahnemann Hospital. They have both faculty and student clinics. Details at woninstitute.edu.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Daniel Siegel about the teenage brain. We have an email from Richard in Wilmington, Delaware. He says, as a family therapist, one of the most daunting and productive challenges is to be an interlocutor between adult and adolescent brains. Can you relate to that, Daniel Siegel? I like that comment. Yeah, go ahead.
To go and try to help adolescents and adults communicate well. It's such a challenge. I'm an adolescent psychiatrist also, so I'm in that role. And when I wrote the Brainstorm book, the idea was to be exactly that, to offer one book, one conversation that both an adolescent and an adult could read and then increase the ability of them to communicate with each other. And I totally agree. And, you know, I think what's exciting about this is that there's also stuff for the adult to benefit from, not just improve their relationship with their adolescent, which of course benefits everyone, but actually even to find this essence that supports an adult's vitality as well.
Mm. Let me get to Madeline from Wilmington, Delaware to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Madeline, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I thought this was a really interesting article just because my brother and I are completely opposite in how we grew up through our teenage years. I'm 21 right now. He's 23, and he went through a normal high school career, went to Berkeley University, you know, is now an engineer, and I kind of did the complete opposite. I spent a lot of time abroad my high school year. I took 2 years off after high school, and it was just a lot different sort of upbringing, and honestly, I feel like I have a little bit more, I'm more capable to handle what life throws at me. I'm a little bit more independent and a little bit more self-confident because I had to deal with a lot of my own issues when I was younger, and so dealing with them, you know, when I'm 30 and 40, as most people in our generations are doing these days. So,
I appreciate the call, Matt. No, I appreciate the call. I think it speaks kind of to what we were talking about, Daniel Siegel.
Yeah, absolutely. I know for myself, you know, I probably was more, was that your brother you're talking about?
Yeah, her brother.
Yeah, so I was probably more like your brother. I kind of went straight through school, never took time off, never did anything. And then when I finally, still an adolescent, was in medical school, I found the lack of my teachers looking into the inner life of their patients very disheartening. So I ended up dropping out of school as an adolescent. So I was at the time 22, 23. And I went on a journey where it was really dealing with my own stuff. No one was telling me what to do. I had organized myself. I had saved enough money to take some time and just do a little bit of traveling. But the issue was exactly like you're saying. I was confronted with myself in a way that in school, going straight through, I never really was even given the opportunity to do. Mm-hmm. So in a way, we don't need to actually drop out necessarily or even travel to do that. We can travel inside our own mind. And there are these skills in the Brainstorm book called Mindsight Skills, which give the opportunity for anyone, whether they're taking time off or actually going through a program, to actually reflect inwardly, to understand the nature of their history in the past, what's going on now, so they can become the active and creative author of their own unfolding life story. So I totally agree with you. I think this chance to deal with our own issues and not just be externally focused is really, really helpful in life, however we take that on.
Madeline, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You had mentioned attachments or attachment, and I think it's tricky in adolescence because you want to keep an eye on your children, but you also want to give them the kind of freedom that we have been talking about, and the sort of, you know, there's been a phrase about, you know, giving them roots and wings, which I guess the goal of a parent during adolescence. How do you then see some of the stresses and strains or the tugging of attachment during those years?
Oh, you know, Marty, that's so beautifully said. You know, there's a whole section in the book on attachment where a way to think about it is this. For a young child, we seek out four S's. We want to be seen by our caregivers. It's often our parents, but it can be other adults as well. other figures who take care of us. We're seen by them. They see our feelings. They respect them. We want to be soothed by them, so when we're distressed, they help calm us down. We want to be safe, meaning both we're safe with them. They don't harm us or terrorize us, but we also want to be protected from harm by them, so safe. And then if we have those three S's of being seen, soothed, and safe, we actually get the fourth S, which is a feeling of security. So this is basically the way we hopefully can set up a foundation as parents with our children so they feel secure. And that's called a secure base or a safe haven that we provided. But then certainly the toddler years and then later on the adolescent years, we also have to provide a very important way in which we are a launching pad. So we need to be there as a solid launching pad because, you know, they're going to have to launch out into the world with this security, having been seen, soothed, and safe, and then feeling secure, but they got to go out in the world. And that's hard for me, I can speak for myself, and I write about this in the book, you know, to let our daughter, our son go and know they're out in the world. You can't control everything that happens to them. You can't tell them, you know, put on your shoes or put on your hat or whatever.
I relate.
And it's really, it's hard. And, you know, in that hardness, of course, is our own journey, which I help parents go through in the book. But for the adolescent going through it, it's also hard. We're going through it in different ways. And, you know, I think if we're at least open about this challenge of attachment, that it's the launching pad period, but we still maintain the lines of communication as parents so that we're still a safe haven. And, you know, my son's been traveling around the world since he finished college now, and I hadn't seen him for a year, and I was teaching in Australia. And I got to say, he's just 24, and for us to have, we had 2 weeks together in a rainforest. It was so beautiful to be able to just be with him, two people together, with this whole history we've had together, me as his father, he is my son. It was just beautiful. And I think there's a way to go through all sorts of challenges and changes of adolescence, but maintain that kind of safe haven and launching pad. And to be aware of that as a parent is so essential. And if you're an adolescent hearing this, you know, it's part of the challenge for you too, because, you know, it feels comforting to come home, and that's great. And it's also a necessary thing when you're ready to go out into the world and launch out to experience life beyond the home.
Let me get Sarah from Lower Merion to join our conversation. Sarah, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I'm 16, and I want to be a neuroscientist, so this is really nice and validating to hear all this. My boyfriend actually is having the same issue. He really, really, and he's probably uses some of these techniques that you're talking about, and because he's very rational. And I was wondering, his parents are very controlling and won't let him, you know, make or take these risks. And I was wondering if you had any advice for, you know, adolescents for how to deal with parents.
Sarah, you're a really good girlfriend. I have to tell you that. And I really appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Daniel Siegel has to say.
Yeah, thanks, Sarah. First of all, you know, the Brainstorm book would be exactly what your boyfriend and his parents could read together. And in their rational way, they could go through, because all the science is there, and then the practices are there, and the direct discussion about what the challenges are of this period. And for them to be able to actually have this neutral zone, the book, to have a conversation directly with each other, I think would be really, really helpful for him. For you as a neuroscientist, I'll say, when you take a look at
a budding neuroscientist, yes.
Interested neuroscientist.
Yes,
thank you
exactly.
Very much, Marty. So, Sarah, as a budding neuroscientist, you know, you might also find the exploration of the brain and other things I've written, the Pocket Guide to Interpersonal Neurobiology, for example, useful in your own growth as an adolescent and even supporting your boyfriend. Because, listen, if we get all on the same page about this, the good news is you can actually increase the way you have respect across the generations. You can increase the way an adolescent himself or herself is integrating her own brain. Because here's the amazing thing. When you know about the brain, what you do with your mind, that is how you focus your attention, how you deal with your thoughts and emotions, and how you interact with other people, all that is about the mind, actually can strengthen the brain and integrate it in a healthy way. And so this is an exciting time, actually, to move toward neuroscience, because we understand that it's a part of the bigger picture of how we can strengthen our minds and our relationships.
Sarah, thanks for your call to Radio Times. Daniel Siegels, you were talking about your son. My son's about 8 years or so older than yours, but I do remember after he came back from college, and maybe it was the first or second year of college, and he was with my husband and myself, and he said a thing that really just blew us together, but just I thought was extremely insightful on his part. And he said, you know, to his dad, he said, "Now I realize when you were fighting with me, you were fighting for me." And I thought that sort of insight that comes, I think, later in life as an adult, when you can look back on your teenage years and they begin to make sense, and those people that you thought were just there to make your life hell were actually there on your side.
Yeah, totally. What a beautiful statement from your son. That is exquisite. Yeah. Mm.
You're welcome. Let me get Phoebe from Westchester to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Phoebe. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a 14-year-old who never seems to remember anything. I mean, simple tasks. Other than his schoolwork and what he really wants, anything else, he doesn't remember, no matter how many times I tell him. I know he's not rude, and he's the kindest little man that I know, but why? What's the problem?
Yeah, well, Phoebe, I mean, obviously we don't know your son, your 14-year-old son, who you say can't remember anything. I mean, I'm not sure it's something that Daniel Siegel could answer directly, but I'd be curious about your thoughts, Daniel.
Yeah, Phoebe, well, thank you for sharing that. You know, in general, to remember something, you have to pay attention. And sometimes people whose attentions wander a lot have a hard time remembering. Other times there are other issues, amazingly. People who are sleep deprived, and adolescents are some of the most sleep deprived individuals on the planet, that actually interferes with both attention and memory. So for everyone listening, we should know that this example of your son, while we can't say specifically what's going on with him, these are really important things about being able to pay attention, being able to actually get enough sleep so that your brain is able to function well. And those are just two things I would say in general. Mm-hmm. And if you're concerned about it, of course, I would go to his pediatrician and have him consider doing an evaluation to make sure there's not something that needs some treatment.
Phoebe, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We have a tweet from Rich. I don't totally understand it, but he says, "How can I reconnect with my adolescent brain to connect with my kid's brain?" But I think what he wants to sort of, I guess, perhaps reinvigorate his adult brain to think about some of the positives we've been talking about.
Absolutely. Well, that's really, really a great question. You know, if you go through the four fundamentals of the adolescent essence, the emotional spark, I would say as an adult, what would be helpful for you to do is to find what really gets you going, what fires you up, what you really care about, and make sure you spend time each day doing some of that. If that's not in your work, then make sure you take time for it on a regular basis to develop your passion. So that's the ES. SE, the social engagement. Make sure you have supportive friendships and really put energy and time into them. A lot of times as adults, we forget to do that. We think, oh, we're adults. We'll just be living in isolation or just with our immediate family. It's very, very important. Every study of adult brain development, every study of mental and medical health, longevity, and even happiness say that our supportive social relationships are the number one factor that supports each of those. And then novelty, make sure you do things in new ways. You know, we can walk around the block if we have dogs, walk around the block in a different way. I mean, literally, make sure you're doing new things. Learn a new language, learn to learn sport, try learning, you know, a new musical instrument. Try new things. Literally, make sure you do novelty in your life. And the fourth thing, creative exploration, is challenge your mind. You know, try reading books you've never read before. Try seeing movies you've never considered seeing before. Keep yourself open and flexible. This is basically, if you had to summarize the idea of the adolescent essence, it's the idea that this process called neuroplasticity, that is how the brain is going to change in response to experience, it's alive and growing in adolescence. In adulthood, if we let that die, our brains will become stagnant. So what you want to do is keep neuroplasticity alive throughout adulthood with these four elements of the essence: emotional spark, social engagement, novelty, creative exploration. And that's how you can do it. And when you do it, I'll bet you'll be able to tune into your adolescence experience much, much better in a more open and connecting way.
we're almost out of time here, but as I was putting the show together, I was thinking about those teenagers who are now young adults who graduate, let's say, from college, but they don't find a job out there that they can afford to take. So they come home. So after all this effort of leaving the family, of creating an independent life, circumstances force you back home. What advice do you have for those young people now and their parents?
No, absolutely. You know, there's a whole section in the book about this because this happened with our son, you know, and it can be challenging for both an adolescent coming back home, let's say in their early 20s, or, you know, the parent. So I talk about it from both points of view. And for us as parents, we need to realize that these are really hard financial times. And, you know, many adolescents are returning home to stay there for a little while. And we need to really understand that this is home base and it can be a good thing. Now, that being said, to move from adolescence to adulthood, what does that take? It means getting ready to take on adult responsibilities of taking on work, earning a living, of, if they're ready, starting a committed relationship and starting a family, if that's their path to take. In doing all that, we need to realize that that's a tough transition and we need to support them as best we can, but in their own timing, it needs to happen so they're not still living with you when they're 40, 50 years old and they can go out and make a life. Because this is the way we all support each other on this important journey of adolescence.
Well, Daniel Siegel, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you, Marty. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. And the book is called Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can leave a comment on our homepage. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You can also download a podcast of the show. Adam Staniszewski, our engineer for today's edition of the show. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant, with Sophie Reed helping us out this week. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.